So this is basically the thing that I'm best known for. It's a building which is patent-free, copyright-free, open source, and all that good stuff, designed for refugees. So these wall pieces are whole 4x8 panels, typically. This is, you know, 1.2 by 2.4 meters. It's a standard industrial size that is used for, you know, essentially absolutely everything. So the advantage of using a standard industrial panel is that it's basically a standard hardware platform, right? It's like using a commodity PC and putting Linux on it, rather than having some weird custom hardware that you're preconditioned for your software will run. This building is made from 12 standard panels, or you can use 18 if you want a bigger one. Plywood is about $5 a sheet, so you can produce some kind of reasonable building for $60 plus screws and hardware, maybe $100, $120, $130. This happens to be one made of cardboard, so this stuff is a lightly material that's taped together, and that triangle or stack of stuff these people are carrying is a folding roof, and you'll see in a moment they pop open the entire roof as a single piece, and the students that you see in this picture actually manufactured all of this folding building stuff in about an hour in the morning, actually about an hour and a half in the morning that we actually, you know, put this up in the afternoon of. So it's all really, really, really simple, right? Your design process is take 6 panels, cut them in half, tape them together, take 6 more panels, use them whole, use them for the walls, boom, there's your building. And the simplicity is what kind of allows for the potential for viral spread, right? It's just really, really, really simple. So this is probably the simplest piece of new generation open hardware. There's a lot of stuff from the 70s and the 80s which is in this general domain that they call appropriate technology. And a lot of that stuff is very interesting, and much of it works sometimes very well, sometimes just reasonably well. But the culture that went along with those technologies was institutionalized NGO culture, and it was academic culture. It didn't have this whole thing of collaborative working. It didn't have this whole approach of kind of using the internet to connect all the people who had an affinity for a given system together to actually do the developmental work. Come on. So all of these kind of new generation ideas that are, you know, very high complexity things like the stuff that Martin was just talking about, which are, you know, have enormous scope but require pretty significant engineering. And then there's stuff like this, which, you know, at the end of the day, it's a hut. It's a hut that's really easy to make with modern materials, and it's got some nice structural properties, and that's what it is. But if you need a hut, it's probably the cheapest, strongest hat that you can make with stuff that comes off industrial supply chains, and that's genuinely useful. Any questions? That kind of makes sense?
No windows?
Well, you cut them where you need them. You know? You just, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty configurable building. So the other thing I want to show you guys is this. This is the other useful thing. So this is a thing which is commonly known as 6 ways to die. And basically there are 6 ways that people die. They can be too hot, they can be too cold, they can be hungry, they can be thirsty, they can be ill, or they can have an injury. And if you don't die one of those things, you're probably not dying. Pretty simple, right? I mean, but the funny thing is that abstraction took me about 5 years to develop and is still regarded as being a major conceptual breakthrough in the field. So...
well, genius, I mean,
you know, you may laugh, right? But at the end of the day, people don't like to think about death. And if you look at, say, the World Health Organization statistics, they'll give you 30, 40, 50 categories of things that people are dying of, which are extremely specific and don't chunk up nicely into strategic planning tools. So you see, there's a set of concentric rings here, right? So you get your 6 ways to die in the middle. The concentric rings go out, and they're a way of mapping the systems which stop you dying of this stuff as a series of concentric rings. But these rings are not rings which measure in distance, they're rings which measure in organization or jurisdiction. So you have your clothes, they're individual. If you've got a house, it's kind of run at a household level. Your electricity is typically generated at a municipal level, right? It's generated by your town. Your water stuff is typically generated by your town. The energy markets that feed your local power station are largely national and international. Your food is typically national and international. It's not usually locally grown. So what you see is that for Westerners, the majority of the stuff that keeps them alive is on these outer rings. It's a long way away from you, and as a result, there's a certain amount of fragility in the systems that we're in. All of these conceptual models are also fully open. They're all public domain. So what I want to point at, I'm just going to pop up one more thing here, is... I don't know why I did that, but I'm just going to do it the other way. That's screwed up the ass. Anyway, so this is a conceptual approach to poverty, right? And we'll go through what is poverty and a few other things, but I wanted to get these kind of basic frameworks in place first. It's a conceptual approach to poverty that says, look, if you can find reasonable ways of providing all of these basic services locally, very locally, preferably individually or at the household level, worst case at the village level, then you could take places where the political unit is the village and nothing more, or you could take places where the village is the only thing that is, you know, the next town is 50 miles away, you're not going to pull infrastructure from the town. You could take that stuff and provide all the services that you need so that people will not die of these things. It's a simple model. But to get that done, you need a bunch of gear, right? You need systems that produce these essential services that will keep people alive. Does this conceptual framework make sense?
So are all the different systems are independent of one another? Is that how you say?
Well, I mean, there might be some interdependence. Come on in.
Oh, sorry, I'm just looking at you. Sorry.
Ah, all right. So there might be. How do I put this? So the systems might be independent of each other, or they might be interdependent, but the point is that they're very, very local, and they tend to have very, very low capital requirements. So, for example, a hexayurt is a very simple kind of building that gives you protection from being too hot and too cold. You could put a solar panel on the outside of it, and then you'd have integration between the systems.
That would work fine for generic services, but if you're talking about highly specialised illnesses, for example, that require very specific equipment.
I'm not talking about any of that, right? But I'm talking, and again, we'll talk about who the market is for this kind of stuff. But right, you know, I would be very happy if we could get clean drinking water and toilets, and maybe something to cook on. Yeah, 5-10 years down the line, I've got some potential approaches that might get very, very simple basic medical services. But you know, Martin's stuff is very much about how could you get first world standards of living using all these open techniques. My approach is, how did you just triage the enormous death tolls from poverty using kind of whatever we can bolt together with string and sealing wax, right? This is way at the other end of the spectrum. Although there are some interfaces, right? I mean, you know, Martian has been building at least one hexier down on the land, and apparently it kind of sort of worked. So, let me pop up the actual presentation. So I wanted to give you guys a little bit of frameworks that we've been thinking in before actually rolling into, you know, the activity. If my Macintosh actually behaves itself. Alright, so second edition of the talk for those who saw the first one in Iceland or watched it on the internet. What I'm going to do is I'm going to basically have a series of 10 4-minute sections, okay? And these will address different parts of this whole question about poverty and open hardware and pictures of global transformation. In each one of those 4-minute sections, I'm going to sort of toss out some stuff, and if anybody has a better idea or anybody's got information to contribute or anybody has questions, jump in, right? But the slides are on a timer, so 4 minutes later, we're going to move on to the next thing. So think in 30-second chunks, and don't hesitate to jump in, because we've got some world-class thinkers here, and there's all kinds of approaches and all kinds of ideas. Just to keep this from turning into a 5-hour workshop, every 4 minutes, we're going on to the next one. Does this make sense for everyone?
Yeah, absolutely.
And jump, right? I mean, you know, I'm just getting...
so creative.
The thing is, I'm going to keep going, right? So you have to interrupt me to get a word in edgewise. right?
Okay.
I might say, I might occasionally pause for questions, but I'm not planning on making a habit of it. You're just going to have to jump in. Reasonable? We all good with that?
Yeah.
All right, say aye. Here we go.
Aye.
Aye. Wait, can I get an R? Pirates. Okay, so, number one, what is poverty? Well, anybody want to give me a quick definition of poverty?
Purchasing power.
You can't buy much stuff.
I'm talking about the alternative, the supposed currency, purchasing power, parity index.
Lack of access to resources.
Lack of access to resources? Okay, I'll give you my definition of poverty. Poverty is when you're so poor you die of being poor.
Lack of necessaries?
If you're so poor, you die of being poor. You have lack of necessaries or inability to access pervasively useful things.
Because social, cultural, institutional,
I'll
shut up in a minute.
No. All of that stuff is completely reasonable, right? All of that stuff is completely reasonable, but, you know, the very most basic level is you die of it. If you're not dying of poverty, you might still be very poor and you might have other problems, but it's a different kind of poverty from this kind of absolute terminal poverty. See what I'm saying? So, what percentage of the human death every year do you think is death from poverty? Take a guess?
90.
90?
No.
20.
Nope. Higher. Lower.
Higher, lower. Okay. I mean, the answer is it kind of depends who you ask, right? Food and Agriculture Organization will tell you that something over half of human death involves some element of malnutrition. However, and if you look at the first Ending Poverty with Open Hardware talk, the URL for that report is on the slides. So, you know, that version of the talk has actual, you know, links to the references. This one is a little more abstract. They'll tell you it's about 36 million of the 60 million human deaths every year. However, a lot of that is very, very, very small contributory factors. If you look at the World Health Organization reports, there's a hardcore lump in the middle of the statistics, which is just plain death by poverty, usually infrastructure failure. Dirty water, diarrhea diseases, just plain old starvation, severe, you know, malnutrition for things like iodine. What else are the basics?
Mosquito nets.
From cooking fires.
Mosquito nets.
Mosquito nets, right? You know, so there's that cluster of all these things, death from poverty, so, you know, you're a little hungry all the time, you're susceptible to malaria or HIV, and you take that entire cluster, it's somewhere between 10 and 30 million people a year, depending on your definitions in the year, of the 60 million people out who die of all causes. So it's between a sixth and a half of human death, depending on where you draw the line. I tend to think it's about a third. And most of that's death of young children. And there's this link that we'll talk about a little later on, that if your kids tend to keep dying young, you tend to have more of them. And if you want two to survive to adulthood, there's a strong tendency to wind up with four, because they're basically backups. If you actually apply like standard portfolio theory analysis to having kids in a high-risk environment, cross our fingers, it's working, right? If you use portfolio theory and apply it to having kids in a high-risk environment, you discover that overpopulation is a rational response to the fact that your kids keep dying of stuff. Okay, now I'm worried that it's not going to move on. Something went wrong. Anyway, so any more thinking about what is poverty? While we wait for the slide, which may never move. Okay, still thinking. Should be 4 minutes. Yes?
Very much socially and culturally ascribed at some points. I mean, like I said about necessaries, if you think about the original neoclassical economic models, they had a very specific way of understanding.
Aha!
That's it, that's all I have to say.
Alright! Keep going, this is a buffer for exactly finishing your sentence.
There you go.
Okay, how can open hardware help? Okay, it's working, cool.
I'm timing.
Alright, so. I remember that diagram I showed you at the beginning of, you know, all these ways that people die and, you know, the stuff we build around us, right? Right now, essentially closed hardware is keeping you alive, right? The plumbing system that, you know, means you don't die of dysentery and cholera, the electricity system that heats this place, Some of that stuff is expired patents and is therefore open kind of by default, but it's all owned by big faceless corporations you've no control over, and it might as well be a closed system, and a lot of it is still patented. So the bottom line is you're currently kept alive for the most part by proprietary systems. Now, if you look at the 3 billion farmers in the world, most of whom are villagers who live on their own land, more or less, or their sharecroppers, almost all of those people are organic agriculturists with almost no ecological footprint, who live entirely on open systems because they don't own anything that anybody wanted to draw an IP fence around. Which is kind of interesting, right? All the places that we're trying to get of, you know, freedom from intellectual property constraints and, you know, minimal environmental impact and organic agriculture and all the rest of this stuff, all of that stuff turns out to be where the poor are already. So what we're trying to do is actually figure out how to make this high standard of living existence sustainable when the poor people already have a sustainable existence. You see this distinction? It's not that we're trying to figure out how to make humanity sustainable. We know how to make humanity sustainable. We go back to organic agriculture, right? But we don't want to do that because that kind of sucks as a lifestyle. So what we're trying to do is, you know, from my perspective, trying to figure out how to make this sustainable lifestyle much more pleasant. And you see this as an inversion of the common model, right? Normally we're talking about how to make high-tech society sustainable. I'm talking about how to make sustainable society pleasant. Completely different way of asking the question. So what kind of systems might fit into that, right? Solar cookers, energy efficient stoves like rocket stoves, composting toilets, Sulab toilets, solar water pasteurization, solar water disinfection, biosand filters, Potters for Peace Filtron, which is a ceramic filter. Come on in, it's fine. See, we've got through water filters, organic agriculture techniques.
The fact that it's closed source at this point, is that the problem?
No, I don't, not necessarily.
You can buy it, obviously, and it will probably be quite cheap because there are several producers producing it. And
which it? Can you be more specific?
Well, I can imagine, for example, for medicine
yes.
That it can open harbor can help, or open medicine can help very much.
Yes.
For HIV, for example, could. Mm-hmm. But for plumbing, I guess that if you can source it locally, which doesn't have anything to do with being open anything, but if you can source it locally, it would be great, I guess. Mm-hmm. But how does the open thing...
Well, I mean, the technologies I'm just listing are all ones which are currently open.
Yeah.
Right. And a good example, and I'm not contrasting this strongly, right? I'm just noting that our industrialized society tends to be mainly proprietary, and agricultural society tends to be mainly open.
Yeah.
Could you have a breakthrough where some proprietary technology went out and absolutely transformed the planet? Sure, think about cell phones. So I'm not suggesting that openness is a necessary precondition to, you know, helping poor people, but I'm just noting that open systems that could solve a lot of these problems do exist.
Yeah.
All right, what's next?
Ready?
All right, can it scale? Right? Because, I mean, this is really the fundamental question. If you've got 20, 30 million people a year dying, we would like that to stop. These people are scattered all over the planet. It's not like it's a concentrated single thing like a genocide. It's this distributed genocide. Can we conceivably reach into all of these corners with something that will help? Now, the cell phone, right? Again, it's primarily a closed platform, although it's beginning to change. The cell phone is already to 50% of the human race. People think it will get to 75% by the end of 2011 and close to 100% by 2020. So the cell phone, I think, is scalable. Right? Is there any reason that you can't scale, let's say, solar panels?
Well,
it depends on the manufacturing technology. Is there any reason you can't scale organic agriculture? Probably not. Right? The best numbers we have on this are from a woman called Yvette Perfecto, who did some studies that were kind of global meta-analysis of the carrying capacity of the global agricultural system if we went fully organic. and her numbers suggest that we could increase developing world food supply by 80% using organic agricultural techniques, which takes them fully into the domain where they have enough to eat all the time. Pretty much everyone. Solar water pasteurization, you know, you heat water using the sun to the point where all the organisms in it that would make you sick die. That's scalable, isn't it? So my suggestion is that, yes, right, an open hardware approach where we take these models of how to build things that will keep you alive and we propagate that information globally to help people build these kinds of things is a scalable approach, yes.
That seems fine for everyday demands. What if there's a disaster or a sudden demand at some point in the system and they don't have the capacity? I mean, do you have, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There needs to be some kind of system, a structure, infrastructure that links up.
Okay, so you're kind of thinking like trade, so you've got a spike demand, right? You have an earthquake, everybody's house falls over, you want to get in emergency.
That's an extreme example, but, you know, just the storm, the electricity line goes down, suddenly they need some influx.
Well, I mean, I'm not suggesting that trade should not happen, and I'm not suggesting that things like NGOs and governments are going to go away. You know, right now, I'm still largely talking about the percentage of the population that's very poorly served by that kind of stuff.
I keep coming back to this. I can't imagine that because I don't live in other worlds, so I need to think more in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to think about the fact that half of the human race basically grows almost all of its own food and eats what comes out of the ground at their doorstep. But that's about how half the human race lives. And then you've got another billion people or so who live in these slums, which are people who left that environment and went to a place where they didn't have any ability to grow their own food, but they still try and exist on basically nothing. And that's, by the time you've got 3 billion farmers and another billion people in slums, that's, you know, 4 billion of our 6.5 billion population, and then there's another billion or so that are kind of in between and marginal. Yeah.
If this works on a moral basis, it's a good thing. The population of the Earth will explode.
No. This turns out not to be true. I mentioned this briefly before. The best predictor for explosive population growth is infant mortality.
Okay, yeah, all right.
The more of your kids...
You're saying they have less kids because...
I'm saying they do have less kids. In the areas where we've seen improvements in standard of living, which bring the infant mortality down, birth rates drop like a stone. Kerala is a very good example. It's a state in India. It's about 60 million people.
Women's education will improve.
Women's education, access to birth control. But the primary driver is lack of infant mortality. Your kids stop dying, people figure out they don't want as many kids. Kerala has a birth rate just above that of Europe on an income of $1 a day, and it's a state of 60 million people. This stuff actually works. Yeah? Yeah. Thank you. So, ecological and macroeconomic constraints. This is a tough one. So, industrial society, we've got about 1.5 billion people in the rich niche, and we are currently utterly trashing the entire planet for everybody else, including all these organic farmers who've been sustainable for thousands of years. So right now, the ecological constraint is we can't keep doing what we're doing, can we?
No.
Right. Thank you. So, right, ecological constraint number one. We cannot maintain the status quo as it is. Second ecological constraint, we definitely can't handle 5 billion more rich people, right? Because that would take our horizon from 50 to 100 years before we've deforested the entire planet to, you know, a week on Tuesday. Global Easter Island is a real possibility. We could cut down all of it. Nuh-uh, I'm not even talking about global warming. Let's just talk deforestation because it's really easy to measure. Right? Thou shalt not. We're not going to do this. So, we can't maintain the status quo, and we certainly can't add 5 billion more people in the industrial ecological niche. Second constraint, global macro. So, right now we're pulling about all of the oil out of the ground that we can. We could increase it by 5 or 10%, might even be able to increase it by 20%, but we certainly can't increase it by a factor of 4.
That's peak oil, isn't it?
No, it's just the fact that we can't get more out. I mean, even if we could continue to increase availability a little, even if it went down a little, the point is we can't multiply it radically.
Yeah.
We're within a margin of pulling all out that we can. So, What happens if you get 5 billion more rich people in the current economic system? You got the same amount of oil, you have 5 times as many people trying to buy it, and what happens is it winds up, instead of being sold as a commodity, where demand is exceeded by supply, so you can only sell it for a little more than the cost of production, you wind up with supply being exceeded, demand exceeding supply, so you wind up essentially auctioning the commodity, right? If you think of typing paper, there's more typing paper than there are buyers, so you can only charge a little more than it costs you to make it. If you think about, well, oil, or you think about the Mona Lisa, there are more buyers than there are sellers, there's more demand than there is supply, so you wind up auction pricing.
That's what caused the crash. As far as I'm concerned, the oil price hitting $150 a barrel, that's what caused it.
Could be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know.
They're causally connected, I think. Totally.
Certainly, there are some really good numbers that show, you know, oil price versus US GDP, and you know, they kind of go like this.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm agnostic. I haven't studied it enough to know. So, the point I'm making is, oil is not the only natural resource that has this kind of situation going on, right? There are all kinds of natural resources, metals, some kinds of energy, yada 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 yada, which, if we increase the demand for them by a factor of 5 or 10, we will wind up with auction pricing. What that means is that most people still won't have access to that stuff, but it will just depend on how much you wanted it, right? You spent your money on auction-priced gasoline, which means you couldn't buy auction-priced cotton. See what I'm saying? The fact is, we can't produce enough stuff for everybody to do what we're doing right now in the way that we're currently doing. Now, there's room for technological breakthrough in those kind of domains, but at the end of the day, what this means is nobody right now that I'm aware of is talking about a plan for a world in which everybody has an adequate standard of living, because all of the people who are talking about doing this through industrial mass production are ignoring the limits on resource pricing and ecological impact. We don't got a plan, that's a problem. Now, of course, he has a plan and I have a plan, and those plans are pretty similar. But in the conventional models, there's no plan for the poor. If the Africans get richer, the Chinese get poorer. And that's basically what auction pricing means. One loses, one wins. Okay. Network availability. This one we might not have 4 minutes on because I think we might all be preaching to the converted. Right? Do we think that everybody in the world will have something like internet access by 2020?
Will they have it? Everybody in the world.
Very close to, let's say within 0.5%.
Yeah,
2020.
If they have mobile phones, they
will be
have
close.
Access by then. So.
Okay. Well, mobile phones, you know, I mean, my take on this, right, is mobile phone to BlackBerry to iPhone to, you know, netbook. I saw a netbook today that cost £100 and was half the weight of my netbook, and it was really, really nice. You know, laptops, desktop computers, supercomputer clusters like Google, right? There's a sort of interlinked variety of hardware platforms that are all kind of blending into each other, and they're all talking to the same essential global network, right? Google now does phone services, you know, you can send SMS to email gateways, everything can talk to the web. You know, one big digital network, lots of access devices with different capabilities to pull stuff out and push stuff in. And do we believe that practically everybody will have a mobile phone by 2020?
Well, within 0.5%, I think.
Within 0.5%.
I won't.
Well, you don't make it, but one other problem to network availability is power at this point.
Electricity.
Because they do it now in Africa with bikes and stuff. And
yes.
You can load them at a school, and you can talk for 30 seconds, and that's not really... It is network availability, but it is not
but
the way
sucks.
We know it. It starts
yeah.
the big time.
So, powering phones and powering little computers.
Yeah.
But Samari, he prepared the internet for all of them. He has that other week.
Oh, absolutely.
That's true.
This whole city, seriously.
If you can do it with plywood and chicken wire, you can do it anywhere. So, on the power front, there are two things. The first is better availability of generation things, like cheaper solar panels, or better wind-up stuff, or better bicycle stuff. The other thing is lower power consumption on the devices because of better processors, e-paper, better battery technology might help, ultra-capacitors, stuff like that. So I'm not going to promise that problem would be solved, but I think there's
2020 is pretty short for that already, I think, because it will take a long time for it is the cost is down enough to for people to be able to buy a mobile phone with a solar panel on the back. You can buy them now.
Yeah,
recently there have been launched several, but yeah, it's a lot of money for these people that make $1 a day and a phone of $20. It's a lot of money.
But they do seem to be buying.
Yeah,
in India and Africa.
It's a business proposition. If you have a phone, mm-hmm. other people will want to use it. Mm-hmm.
But there are charges, solar charges for Chinese batteries. The Chinese batteries cost maximum £3. The phones could be used phones. You name it. I think there's a lot of solutions.
Yeah, this will happen. In 10 years, 12 years.
Say again?
There's a project called Village Phone. Which
one phone per village?
Yeah, basically. And you stick that in with a bunch of Asterix PDXs and problem solved.
So, I mean, I think, you know, there's some question about what kind of devices the very poorest will have and how many people will just be so poor or for some other reason fall completely off the edge of the grid. But I think, you know, there's basically consensus that this is fairly doable.
This is a bit incredible. I mean, there's people living in camps and they have much other concerns.
There are people living in camps who send text messages to the World Health Organization to complain.
You know what I'm saying?
No, I mean,
it's not an essential thing. I mean,
yeah, but I mean,
it's not the survival.
But the empirical evidence is that people who are making less than $1 a day buy cell phones. All over Africa, all over India, all over South America, that actually happens.
And color TVs, by the way.
Say again?
And color TVs,
absolutely. There's a great paper, I'm breaking my own real rule here, but you know, do what that works for the whole law. So there's a paper called The Economic Lives of the Very Poor, which actually, it's online, and it talks about exactly what the dollar a day people spend their money on in different parts of the world, and it's a fantastic read. The Economic Lives of the Poor, top. All right. Documentation and translation. Next issue, right? So let's say that we've got a design for a toilet, and I'm going to pick a thing called a Sulab toilet, which is basically a brick-lined hole in the ground. It's a very, very simple toilet technology. It's got pretty reasonable performance. You know, there might be better ones, there might be worse ones, but it's a typical sustainable toilet design. Suppose that we were going to try and promote the Sulab toilet technology over the entire world so that everybody in the world, if they needed a toilet, would know that design existed and know how to build it. Does that seem like it might be a reasonable goal for some group of people?
Sure.
No. So, they'd have to do two things to get this to happen. The first is, they'd have to document how you build one of these toilets, right? Now, that might be video, it might be audio, because people can't read, it might be written instructions, it might be pictures, it might be a whole combination of different kinds of media that describe the toilet from a whole bunch of different, you know, ways of description or approaches or ways of thinking. You might do training programs, you might do all kinds of stuff. But your first challenge is you've got to document the technology at a high enough standard that somebody in a tiny village with no education on the other side of the world can download your documentation and understand how to implement one of these toilets. Now, here's your first challenge. If you get that documentation wrong, people will die because they will build the wrong toilet and then they will get cholera. Right? So this is safety critical information transfer between different cultures. Does that sound like a hard problem to anyone?
You can try to write IKEA instructions and build a desk.
Right. So actually documenting this stuff well enough that you can get people to build it from plans when it's safety critical. You get it wrong and people die is a very hard problem of a kind that is not typically seen. That's not a problem that as a culture we've really spent a great deal of time wrestling with in the past couple of centuries. So we've got to develop some understanding of how to do documentation of safety critical systems which will be built by people that were never ever likely to have much dealing with.
We should ask aircraft engineers.
Yes.
These guys have experience with this.
Absolutely. And with topic two, which is translation, right?
Exactly.
You know, there's a whole business, right, where you take an airplane, fly it to, Brazil, they do all of the scheduled maintenance, and then they fly back again.
Yeah.
And it's, right. So, yes, that's an excellent point. We get safety critical engineering gurus.
Probably.
It's a good idea.
Other ideas?
Yeah. On the translation side of it, right now we don't have a big internet translation engine that kind of is big and massive and powerful in the same way that, say, Wikipedia is.
And it doesn't handle most of the world's languages, it just handles the big ones.
Wikipedia?
No, like translation engines and Wikipedia,
yeah.
In fact.
Yeah. But, well, I'm not talking about automated translation, I'm just talking about tools for people to work together on translations. Right now, we don't have a big website, which is, you know, the global non-profit translation hub, where you can upload text and volunteer translator.
TravelWiki.
TravelWiki, but it's not big yet. Right? I mean, it's there is something there. Is it the right one? Do they have the right tools? Is there the awareness? We don't know. At the end of the day, we don't have a big central resource. We're going to need one to get this safety critical information available in all the forms it needs to be in. I would personally like to see it loaded onto the phones when you buy them, so you don't even have to pay for the bandwidth. That would be really cool. Okay, eating our own dog food. Martin, do you want to take this one?
No.
God damn it. All right. So this is a phrase from the computer industry. It just means if you don't use the software that you write, if you don't use the products you design, you're just not really going to get anywhere. Right? And this is a very... could you keep that running?
No, the battery's gone.
Battery's gone. Disaster. Okay. All these things happen.
Oh, you have one?
Yeah.
Oh, I could have warned you earlier then.
Sorry.
How long is that? Yeah, from 10.
Oh, well, that's fine. So, good job that we weren't doing anything complicated with the slides. So, eating your own dog food. This whole thing of using the systems that you promote is a really, really, really critical part of getting things done in the world in an open source way. You know, the open source guys have this thing that you've got to scratch an itch that you have. One of the approaches that I'm kind of taking to this, other than attempting to figure out how to spend a year living in my own, you know, hexa yard with all the infrastructure stuff around me, which I've been trying to find funding for a while, is this notion of an appropriate technology village. Now, this is a little different from the open source ecology village, which is very, very high tech and it's very much a research sector. What I'm talking about is getting together a couple of solar cooking charity people, a couple of toilet charity people, a couple of water charity people, a couple of farming charity people, and getting all of them with their gear on a village somewhere in the world. And probably that village would be mainly made of other NGO people, because you get a whole bunch of additional problems when you start trying to teach the locals. So let's just say we go somewhere, we build a village from scratch.
They would all die.
Well,
right?
You
don't do that.
You know, survivor appropriate technology, right? If you are telling me that this system is good enough for the Africans and the Indians and, you know, the South Americans to use.
I just said you don't.
Oh.
There it's on.
It's on. Oh, and then you just hit the record button. So if you're going to tell me that this system is good enough for the Africans and the Indians and so on to use, at some point, you ought to be willing to use it yourself. Does that seem reasonable?
Absolutely.
So if you had one village in which you had all of the systems together, the one thing which hasn't been done a lot in this whole appropriate technology game is people haven't worked a lot on systems integration. Right? There's not a ton of cooperation between the various charities that have formed around various technologies to actually get all of that stuff in the same place at the same time to make sure that it all works together. Yeah?
The majority of the world's population lives in cities or in villages, the rich world lives in cities. Right?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the rich world isn't really dying of being rich in the same way that the poor world is dying of being poor.
But you said that if we would apply to in our society.
No, what I was more suggesting is that the appropriate technology designers, the people who've got technologies that they're trying to promote in the developing world, should go to the developing world and use their own systems for a couple of years.
Okay.
Now, if that works really well, there might be some back transfer, you know, some reverse leapfrogging or whatever you want to call it, or there might not. But I think that to get the fit and finish, to get the polish on these technologies to the point where we all agree, yeah, that really works great, that's a really good system, I think we're going to need to get the engineers who are designing these systems to live with them for a long time in a way that demonstrates that you can maintain a high standard of living using these very simple approaches. And I think that has to be, you know, kind of a testing centre, which is sort of parallel to, you know, Martin's idea of a research centre. And I'm not saying that there wouldn't be any innovation there, but it's more about long-term wearing in of the system where you use it every day and you notice that the handle needs to be on the other side because once in a while you jam your wrist. You know, that kind of stuff. Also, just, you know, if it's good enough for me, it's good enough for you. The Gandhian thing would be the change you want to see in the world. I used this toilet for 2 years. I'm telling you, it's good enough. Whole different thing. Yeah. All right, identifying the developer community. So, in the open source software game, by and large, there are two kinds of developers. There are people who are paid to develop it for some reason, some company wants it made, and there are people who do it because it solves a problem that they have or it suits their own kind of aesthetic drive. Right now, open source appropriate technology is largely unfunded. Right? It's the charities that are doing that kind of appropriate technology work tend not to have a ton of money. There are all kinds of structural problems with research funding for appropriate technologies. It's just kind of tough. Part of this is because the wrong people are doing the development work. Right? Basically, you've got a bunch of, generally speaking, you know, comfortably off-white males who don't miss meals very often, particularly beige meals, right? Working on developing these technologies, right? And at the end of the day, that's the equivalent of paid developers in the Linux community. They're very important, but at the same time, they're not necessarily the best people to solve some classes of problems, and they're very expensive. So my assertion, and this is very much a guess about the future, but my assertion is that in future, the vast majority of open source appropriate technology development work will be done by villagers. And it will be done by, you know, engineers who are living with these systems because that's the stuff that they grew up with. And they'll continue to refine these systems and publish changes. Does that seem reasonable?
Sure.
Right? I mean, you know, if you're living in some village and you're, you know, dinking around with solar panels to charge cell phones and you know, read up on a little bit of electrical engineering stuff because you want to know why it's broken and you figure out what a capacitor is and that the capacitor is burned out. And then you make some simplifications because, you know, the way that it fits into the waterproof case isn't quite right. You always thought it would be simpler for the other thing. You know, you wind up with evolution of design by the communities that are using them. Is that a question or are you just yawning? All right. So, that, I think, is going to be a very significant change in the centre of gravity in the open source appropriate technology game. When the developer community is primarily in the developing world, when it's primarily poor people who are living with these systems day in, day out, and doing a little engineering with what spare time they have and what material resources they have, I think we're going to see a massive acceleration in the speed of development of these technologies because we will have got the correct developer community working on the problem. At which point, the various technology charities and the various research charities and the various funding charities will then be largely sponsoring the research of these field engineers who are living with the systems that they promote. Does that seem reasonable? And there are some examples of this, right? There's a guy called Sharada Prasad, if I'm getting his name right. Sharada Prasad is the other guy. I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but I can only remember his YouTube handle, which is Zen Rain Man. So Zen Rain Man on YouTube is an engineer who is relatively middle class, lives in India, and his house has all of these appropriate technology systems, and he lives in them. He drinks the rainwater, and he grows some of his food on his roof, and, you know, he does a whole bunch of other stuff. It's a compressed earth block house, be glad to hear. And, you know, Zen Rain Man is demonstrating that this stuff is good enough for him, and now his neighbours are copying his designs. That, to me, looks like a win. And if we had 500 Zen Rain Men, we would have massive progress, and I think we're going to see them pretty soon. And to me, this is the thing of, because we've got
kind of
Zen, Z-E-N,
yeah.
Rain, R-A-I-N, Zen, Rain, Math.
That is a real name?
No. That's just his YouTube handle. I'm completely, his real name is completely escaping me. I hope that made sense because it's over now. Alright, so, identifying the correct developer community, right? The thing about developing world developers is they are extremely cheap. Right? I mean, these guys are making $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 a year. It's a very small sum compared to the price of putting an engineer in an office in Boston. So what development resources are available in the future may go far further. There might be taps into existing funding streams like the World Bank, and rather than putting $300 million behind building a dam, maybe they'll put $300 million behind a whole series of micro-infrastructure projects. It could actually happen in the future. There are unicorns and fairies. But, you know...
Oh, fine pig.
But you might also see developing world governments get behind this, right? I mean, if I said to you that the Brazilian government in 10 years might have a significant appropriate technology R&D program that, you know, exported ideas globally, that might be believable.
Saddam Hussein had one.
Cuba. Right? Cuba are the world experts on, you know, society, you know, full society organic agriculture. Their calorific intake dropped by 30% after the Soviet Union collapsed, and they built it right back up again using organic ag. Yeah.
If you're proposing coming up with a set of models that could be supposedly replicable for a number of developing areas, am I getting it right? I mean, is this what you're saying?
Yeah.
Could you not say, are you Scottish?
Half Scottish, half Indian.
Okay, and you're working at the university?
No.
Okay.
I'm a hippie.
You still want to have access to this. I'm just thinking, have you looked into FP7 money? That's it, EU...
No.
We'll talk later.
I mean, that'd be great. I just, you know,
it's
in general.
It's not hard, actually, if you're doing the right stuff. You just have to have a network and clearly has it.
Well, I mean, I don't. I have no idea how to get money out of the EU because it's this whole thing of, like, you know, spelunking into Dante's Inferno. You need a special set of skills to go down in there and come back out. Especially with money.
Like, a manual for how to apply is about 300 or 400 pages.
Yeah, I went to a workshop.
But
funding particular things right now, and this kind of thing would be.
That would be fantastic. I mean, I would want to know. If you have those specialised skills, I'd be very grateful because I can really use some dough to do some of this stuff in the field.
There are millions and millions of pounds.
Oh. This is the right answer, right? This is the right. And we can do, you know, international collaboration. I know
it's
a big part of that stuff.
It is huge.
And we can get the international collaboration side sorted really quickly.
Which has ICT related as well.
Oh, yeah. ICT for DE, international collaboration. I mean,
no, I'm serious. This is the.
No,
I'm.
I'd be building up.
The right kind of proposal.
But I mean, you know, I'm absolutely serious. We have an international network that's working on this kind of stuff already. Putting some money behind that would be fantastic.
This is your most successful slide so
far. Well, you know, didn't I say that? You know, the whole thing was about the interactivity of, you know, if you've got a world class audience of, you know, smart cookies, what's the point in, you know, talking while they all just sit there listening? Right? You know.
She's got a practical.
Solutions, absolutely. All right, so funding. Any more thoughts on funding?
Yeah, you might be able to crowdsource it. Peer-to-peer loans.
That's not my department. I mean, I know it's possible in theory.
No, but you can ask for help from people that do that. I don't know them, but I know from, lost the name, there is this Dutch NGO that is working. Well, peer-to-peer you can call it, actually. Mm-hmm. They just solve problems.
Oh,
so they essentially Kiva with collateral.
Oh, do you remember what they're called?
No, a friend of mine's working on it.
All right, cool. Send me an email.
Yeah.
All right, so now we get to... All right, final one of the main sequence, right? Shape of the future world. What do we think the world is going to look like in 20 years, right?
Suppose we won.
Right. Yeah. Sorry about that. So here's roughly how I think the world is going to look in the future. I think we're still going to see 3 billion or more people doing most of their food by growing it themselves. I actually think the number might be closer to 5 billion. I think that we're probably going to see major industrial centers that do things like solar panel manufacture, computers, satellites, radio gear, this kind of stuff. And I think that we're going to see essentially a divided world in which you've got big high-tech industrialized centers that largely grind out these complex high-tech products, and then huge, you know, infinite fields of medium-tech peasant farmers who've got laptop type computers and solar panels on their roofs and toilets that they built themselves, and they grow most of their own food. And because they've got access to really advanced, understanding of their food supply, so on, they work 4, 5, 6 hours a day and spend the rest of their time doodling on the internet. Yes.
Why do you talk about farmers? Let me just present a slightly different scenario. Mm-hmm. With these farmers, and not just farmers, but they are producers of livelihood. They are producers of circumstances, like buildings, like healthcare, and a lot of different things that draw a lot of population out of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fun being a farmer. Mm-hmm. It's fun living in a community that has the same access to cultural resources mm-hmm. as the city itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that cannot be solved on an individual basis.
Well, I mean, I fully believe that farmers are going to continue to be farmers. I don't fully believe that they're going to have the same access to cultural resources as they would get in the cities. They'll have the same access to electronic resources, but I don't think they'll have the same access to, say, theatres or symphonies.
Or large gene pools.
Or large gene pools.
Or expensive health systems.
Or expensive health systems.
No, the equivalent of all that.
I think they're going to stay damn poor, but I think they will stop dying of being poor because they'll figure out how to be damn poor and also have great access to clean water and toilets and work and that kind of stuff.
But
we're talking about dropping the price of essential services to the point where farmers can afford them.
So my point is that the farmers would not be able to buy all those beautiful tools
mm-hmm.
because that would not be economically feasible.
Ah, okay, so this is a critical point, right? The wood gasification stove is $15, the cell phone is about $20, the computers are maybe $100, and they could easily last for 10 years if you built them properly. They could actually last a lot longer if you built them properly. The toilets are $5 or $10. The organic agriculture stuff is basically free, it's knowledge and technique. Right? So all of this stuff, if you get it right, is completely affordable to people who make their living growing food with their hands. That's the magic of it. That's why we've got
massive production of solar panels will actually bring the prices really, really low.
Yes. I actually fully believe that we're going to see solar electricity drop to 20% or 10% or even 5% of what it currently costs within 5 years.
How do you face the mass exodus from rural areas right now?
The mass exodus from rural areas is reversed. In China this year, 26 million people went back to the villages because they couldn't get jobs in the cities.
Well, the same is happening in a lot of countries after the financial collapses started happening.
Right, the promise that you can move to the cities and get rich has gone away, and now they're going back to the villages where at least they eat. Now, I'm not saying that's a permanent trend, but I'm saying that it's not as if this was an inexorable thing, right? They went to the cities.
I'm not thinking it's desirable, but it's not working by farming alone.
But I mean, what I'm saying is it's happening. Right? The people are leaving the village. In China, at least, they're leaving the cities and going back to the villages.
But it's because of the crisis, because of the fall down. I mean, that's not the perspective we want to have.
Well, I mean, capitalism is unsustainable.
Sure.
That means it stops. Once it stops, where do you go? If you want to keep eating, you go back to the villages. I mean, I'm really serious about that. So, there are some additional slides that we could play with if we want to, or we could stop right here.
I think... just if you want to have a discussion with it with people, or do you want to keep going? It's up to you.
We got about 10 more minutes of stuff that's kind of in this format, or we could do something else. What do you guys want to do?
Did you show the 6 ways of lying?
Yeah, we talked about that at the beginning. You want to continue?
I would say we have 10 or 15 minutes left. So.
Yeah. So
well, let me show you the first of these. Do you guys want to play with this one, or should we do something else?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So, do you want to take a crack at it? In the future, is there human dignity? And this gets into things like political rights. What do you think?
Yes, there is human dignity in the future.
Okay. Tell me about this future human dignity.
I can only get a glimpse of it every once in a while. I'm, not running from oppression, but there is some modicum of a collection of respect and instantiation, embeddedness that people deserve inherently in their environment and in the relationships that they have with the people and the resources there.
Hmm.
isn't our concept of dignity changing as a result of surveillance, and how much we can expect to have our privacy actually respected? So dignity, I think, will have to transform in terms of its generally accepted understanding of what that means. I mean, I don't feel dignified enough to know that I'm being photographed 200 times a day when I'm walking around in the city, you know.
I think I may end up being like, you know, how much serotonin I'm allowed on a regular basis. Because I can overcome almost anything if I got enough serotonin and dopamine. But if I don't have lysine, I can't make it. You know, so I mean, that's kind of,
yeah. No, I totally understand what you're saying. You know, liberation. Palm of your hand. So, I mean, I think that this idea that there's a reasonable prospect for future human dignity is fairly important, right? Because there's a lot of, you know, awful, grim, meat-hook future, 1984, you know, psychic terror pessimism, right? Do you know this Primal Scream album, Exterminator? It's really, really good. You know, it's basically this science fiction concept album about, you know, what happens when you get this kind of effective global fascism. It's just important, I think, that we have a pretty good sense that there are ways forward which do not take us into these abominable futures. The cheap solar panel thing, NanoSolar, Konarka, these guys with these big parabolic bubbles, the open source, you know, solar steam turbine stuff, margin. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that might get us out of this thing of having an absolute lock on the amount of available energy. And if you've got enough energy, you've got cheap access to energy, you've got cheap access to information, maybe a lot of these political problems just sort of mellow out.
No, I think you're dealing with a class of powerful people who are maintaining their position of power, and that's what you're up against.
Powerful people maintain their dignity. Rifles?
Say again?
Rifles?
Rifles? I don't know. I mean, in general, I think the AK-47 has been a destabilizing influence rather than a stabilizing influence.
No.
No, but
that's for me.
But here's the thing, right? But here's the thing. On the other hand, in the 20th century, governments killed 160 million people in prison camps. And all of those people were people who didn't have guns. So, yeah, I mean, I personally, I think that the right to keep and bear arms is a part of human dignity. I certainly wish I lived in a culture which took it seriously, like, say, Switzerland, which, as we know, has terrible gun crime and shootouts in the streets all the time, just like Detroit. I mean, Switzerland is packed to the gummels with assault rifles, and they don't have gun crime on any kind of scale. So, you know, it's not that guns produce violence in all societies.
So
it's that violent societies with guns have real problems.
How did we get from building sustainable housing to ensuring your own security?
Well, we talked about, is there human dignity and the ability to withstand tyranny and win and survive is part of having dignity. It's just a messy part. All right. What's the next one? So, three basic options for the future, right? Barbarism, stasis, and ultra technology. So barbarism is, you know, this kind of Planet of the Apes scenario where everything goes horribly wrong and it's Mad Max. And,
yeah,
you know, peak oilers are really specialists in barbarism, right? And they're not the only ones, but, you know, specialists in barbarism, survivalists, there are lots of little barbarist cults. And, you know, it's reasonable to say that a pretty good percentage of the human race already lives in these conditions, right? I mean, this is not a joke. Right, I mean, there are plenty of places that are essentially Mad Max right now. You know, the one that everybody keeps talking about is Somalia, but Somalia is typical. It's actually got quite a lot of order. It's got free market courts. It's got, you know, but so stasis is the model that your governments tell you about. Right, the future is going to look like the present, only with more growth. People will have the same kinds of jobs. Your kids will continue to be vaguely understandable to you. The internet will continue to be for porn. You know, it's just a very limited model of the future, which is endemic in government. Ultra technology, Smaumi, do you want to take this one?
No,
you're good.
All right. So, ultra technology is, you know, nanofabs, replicators, programmable matter, casual genetic engineering, printers that, you know, you feed it the file for a mouse, and a live mouse comes out the other end.
Downloading chicken sandwiches off the internet.
Downloading chicken sandwiches off the internet. Excellent phrase, thank you. So that kind of, you know, downloading chicken sandwiches off the internet future is very technologically feasible, right? If you've got abundant access to information and abundant access to energy, globally speaking, you stabilise the kinds of political mayhem that might put society at risk of collapsing into a domain where it no longer had the ability to develop ultra technology. Right? You know, barbarism is bad for ultra technology development, generally speaking. Right? Stasis, we might eventually get ultra technology, but I personally think that there's a pretty good partnership between appropriate technology and ultra technology. That you can have, you know, ultra technology cities that develop these enormously powerful techniques, and then that stuff percolates out into the villages depending on what's useful to them. I mean, the mobile phone is ultra technology, and it turns out the villagers love mobile phones. But at the same time, we don't have any ultra technology to get them clean drinking water. For that, we need to use solar cookers, or we need to use, you know, ceramic dishes or biosand filters, all of which are very low technology. But this idea that you could have bits of ultra technology in the villages alongside, you know, your microprocessor and your hoe as a natural partnership, I think that's what the interim phase looks like until everybody gets access to ultra technology for anything they want. And that's a, you know, depending on how good the ultra technology gets, how quickly. Does that seem reasonable?
Are you talking about a development model or a political model? Because it seems to be a bit of both, and I'm not quite clear what's the role of the state. You're talking about assuming their security, that sort of stuff. But, you know, or I'm a bit confused about what exactly you're proposing.
I think the state is a little confused about the role of the state.
Because that's not an answer. That's just
How about technological solutions to political problems?
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it, right? I mean, if you live in...
Technological solutions to political problems.
Let me give you an example of that. The power grid in Iraq is permanently broken because it's impossible to rebuild a power grid in a war zone. However, it's impossible to restart an economy if you don't have a power grid. So Iraq is in a catch-22 because electrical power to run an economy is assumed to come from a power grid which is inherently brittle and can't be built in a war zone. If Iraq had been retrofitted with solar panels and maybe wind in some places and hydro and, you know, all this kind of stuff, then you could have rebuilt the electrical infrastructure, which might have started an economy, which might have led to a reduction in the amount of fighting there. And, you know, I guess my sort of take on this stuff is that the state is limited by the technological choices that it makes, and the people can often do a lot of the work that the state currently does using new technology.
Well, you started talking about security, which is a really key thing. I mean, if there's no state to guarantee security, then everybody's going to have a gun. I mean, there's no other way.
In most cases, the state does not guarantee security.
It's supposed to. It might not be performing properly.
For most people in the world, the state does not provide security. Only for a few people does the state provide security. Most governments don't provide security.
Well, they do. I mean,
no, they don't. No. In the Congo, the state does not provide security. In Iraq, the state does not provide security. In Afghanistan, it does not provide security.
In the UK?
The state was the threat to your security. Right? In most cases, this is the point about, you know, 160 million people. Wait. Stop. This is important. In the 20th century, the state murdered 160 million people. That's about a third as many people as were killed by smallpox. It's four times as many people as were killed in wars. This idea that the state provides security is a limited truth. It's only true in some places and sometimes. I'm talking about the state. The difference between a totalitarian state and a non-totalitarian state. Remember, Hitler was elected.
Tony Blair was elected.
But he's much less successful. The point that I'm making is the assumption that the state protects you is fallacious, and this is extremely important.
But then everybody's got to have a gun. Or there has to be some sort of militia. You see, we're going into this political.
All I'm saying is
if you cannot trust the state to provide for your security, you might have to provide for your own. So, next point. Living in a 6 billion person world, okay? So, I want to point out a phenomenon that has been a big part of my life recently, which is the inability to keep track of everything that's going on. Right? The more I get connected to these cool groups of people who are really thinking intelligent thoughts, the more I realize that even the 1 in a million human intelligences, there are 6,000 of them, And if it takes me 6 months to wrap my head around the life's work of each 1 in a million human intelligence, I would need to live for 500 years. Right? I've hit the wall recently. I cannot really deal with any more smart people. Right? Right? I mean, this is, you see what I'm saying, right? There's this problem that we are both bandwidth limited in that it takes too long to absorb the ideas, and we're capacity limited in that you can't remember the stuff because there's so much of it. It's insane.
So the good thing is, don't consider the smart people a resource that you can draw from. Consider them rather like a repository where you can drop things.
Mm. Mm. That's a good model, right? My approach right now is I'm just ignoring them.
The other model is to develop software, so you've got a limited capacity to take it all in, and you just develop your own software to be able to...
Something that does some of my thinking for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reddit.
Well, specialization. Focus on the people who are exactly working in the same field that you do.
Good work.
It's the only thing that helps.
Well,
but then you miss.
Generalizing.
Yeah, you miss a lot, sure.
I mean,
at least you keep focus on something.
I'm kind of a generalist, so my speciality is generalists.
Yes.
Oh dear, it's a bad place to be. So the point that I want to make here, right, the sort of core of this thing is we're now past the point where there's any hope of getting a general grasp of human knowledge, right? I mean, it's just not going to happen, and it gets worse the more people get online. Right? For one thing, the number of people, the number of these 1 in a million intelligences that can send me email is going to go up by a factor of 5 in the next 10 years. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. The number of 1 in a million intelligences that send me an email is going to increase by a factor of 5 in the next 10 years. Does that seem a little exciting?
I'm excited
too, right? Because what's about to happen is all of the smart people in the world are about to get on the internet.
They're all going to call me.
It could happen. And I'm very excited about that, but I'm also a little scared by it.
And I don't want to ignore it.
Because this thing about more and more and more and more smart people getting online, more and more and more people getting online is one thing, but more and more and more of the world-class intelligences that have had no way of communicating outside of their villages until now, all those people are about to get access to the internet, and the next generation are going to self-educate online. So the amount of human intelligence in the game of solving the world's problems is about to go up by a factor of 5. And I think that's pretty cool. Maybe 6. All right, so we're done. That is the last slide.
Yep.
Thank you very much. Now, we could take some actual more formal questions, or we could just get out here.
Maybe,
time to get out of here? All right.
Maybe one or two.
Yeah, okay.
What's it like to work with the army?
What's it like to work for the army? Okay.
You've been doing contracts for some of this stuff.
That's right, yeah.
That's great.
So my experience with US DoD is this. In the, let's say, 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, the primary visible threat to, you know, the safety and stability and happiness of the world was the USSR. Because quality of life in the Soviet Union was extremely low, the government was really extremely vicious and evil, and they really would have expanded over the entirety of Europe and the rest of the world given the chance. So a lot of people like us went into the military because that was the pressing problem, and then they won, and nobody threw a party and said, you can go home. Right? So you had a lot of extremely idealistic, globally motivated, altruistic people who had turned their plowshares into swords because that was the immediate threat of the day, who then found themselves basically, and I don't want to put this in too fine terms, but basically found themselves with nothing that seemed that pressing, right? There was this kind of period between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the current unpleasantness, right? which left these people kind of looking around at the world wondering what the next priority was. And they did an enormous amount of really good thinking, and they got into this thing of like, well, you know, what other ways can we use the capabilities we have to help? So there was a lot of research on disaster relief, there was a lot of looking at infrastructure protection, you know, a lot of really interesting things happened. So my experience in the military has been particularly the people who went in during the immediate threat from the Soviets are very idealistic and very well-intentioned. But it's still military. So I won't do anything that isn't public domain, I won't do anything that is not published. And that means there are a whole bunch of things going on in there that I will never get to see. I don't have a security clearance. I will not take one. I'm almost certainly unclearable, and I will say anything that it takes to maintain that. Right?
Okay.
That's how I draw a firewall between the areas where we can all collaborate under open licenses, because, you know, license laundering. Where, you know, if they put it in the public domain pool and I put it in the public domain pool, we can use each other's stuff with no complexity. You know, it's just, you can work with people who aren't like you, but you have to be clear about what your boundaries are. Are we done? Is
yeah,
there one more?
I think, well, it's only, I don't see any hands, so I think we have to stop because of the next presentation.
All right.
Thank you very much.